we trust. In charge, we're not sure about.
Welcome to the In Tech We Trust podcast. And you know what? We trust in technology because what the hell, you cannot trust in human beings. So between the four of us, we could not manage to get a year's worth of podcasts. We like failed on episode number 50. There was no podcast last week. Well, at least I didn't see one. What the hell is with that? What was the deal last week, guys? What went on?
Lack of cycles,
yeah.
Actually, I was at OpenStack Silicon Valley presenting at the same time that the show was going on. So it was just one of those things that I think we tried to get a call going. Oddly enough, with Mark and I both being in Silicon Valley at the same time, you think it would be easy.
No sweat, though. So we've got a special guest on with us this week anyway, Greg Farrow from Packet Pushers. How are you, Greg?
I'm doing very well. It's nice of you to care.
No, it's a pleasure. And I'm thinking it's something in the name Greg that must make people like prolific podcasters, right? Like we all totally failed last week, couldn't get a single year's worth of podcasts done without missing a week. Yet yourself and your namesake, Greg Nieman, at least in the IT industry, have got to be among the most prolific podcasters out there, right? How long have you been going for, Greg?
We started podcasting in 2010. So in 5 years, we've published just a shade under 450 shows.
Wow, that is a lot of shows.
Yeah, so nowadays the Packet Pushers has diversified. We actually have multiple channels. We have the main show, which is just like this show, where we deep dive on topics, and then we have a news show, as well as having a separate channel where we talk about even nerdier deep dive stuff as we go, like picking apart little tiny bits of networking. And we also have a community channel, so anybody in the community can bring a podcast. If you think you've got one and you come and bring it to us, and then we'll publish that out so anybody can hear the information that you want to share with the community around us.
You know, of the different shows and the different channels and things that you've got, for you as a podcaster, what's your favorite type of show?
I think the one I enjoy most is The Network Break, which is like a news show. We aim to finish it in 30 minutes and hustle through it as quickly as possible. And that, so instead of opining and wanging on and letting it run too long, we do it very short, very sharp, get in, get out, and move on.
Hey, that's interesting, actually, because Rick and Mark, you guys were on that show with me a couple of weeks ago, weren't you? Where we proper hustled through it. You know,
yeah.
We almost didn't make it that week. Three of us just joined a call and were like, what the hell's going on in the news this week? And just threw out there what we had. It was pretty good fun, yeah?
Well, you know, there was a certain efficiency level to it. I mean, the Express Edition, exclusive, because
yeah,
we only have 30 minutes, right? No, we made things fall up in that example. Yep.
I didn't waste any time talking about beer, I don't think, that week, but I did sound like I came out of a beer can just like now.
Very good, yeah. Speaking of sounding like you come out of a beer can, you don't sound like you're coming out of a beer can this week, Gabriel. So what's
yes,
going on with you? We've only got probably 5 minutes with you before you need to duck off.
I have to go. I got pulled in to go do the Storage V-Experts game show with Vaughn Stewart and a bunch of others. Here is a last-minute addendum at VMworld, so I'm going to go in and do that. It's the last speaking session I have of the day after six or seven sessions.
Oh.
Boy, my voice is toasted, and it's been a great show in terms of engagement at my end, but in terms of you know big earth-shaking revelations, there's just not a lot to really talk about at the old VMworld this year.
Well, before we talk about anything on VMworld itself and announcements and stuff, Gabriel, while you were there, you did do a live streaming podcast thanks to the guys at V Brown Bag. Yeah, do you want to tell us just quickly a bit about that?
Yeah, no, it was great. I had a panel of guests. I had Tim Jabot, who's VM Cutlip on Twitter, and then Lauren Malhoit from Cisco.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tim Antanowatz, who is currently unemployed, and just a good round table of guests up there on the DS. And for about 45 minutes, we did a kind of informal In Tech We Trust and got some good perspective about some of the stuff that's going on in the industry.
And we will stick links to that, or we'll work something out in the show notes, yeah, so that anybody who didn't catch the live stream can catch up on that, yeah?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's you'll be able to go to the V Brown Bag channel and see the podcast live. It's got a very late night with David Letterman feel to it.
Oh, yeah.
As well as we'll be able to pull the audio out and probably add it as a special addendum show for In Tech We Trust.
Cool. So just before you go then, Gabriel, with regards to announcements and things that have come out, we've got, well, I think a couple of things that I thought I'd be quite keen on your take on very, very quickly, because I know you've got to go. vSAN 6.1, did anything grab you with regards to that? And also, has there been any, I don't know, interesting moves or talk around vVols, you know, the perennial, is it ever going to happen technology in the storage world?
Well, you know, I mean, so vSAN 6.1, just basically, you know, it's a service pack update, essentially. And then they telegraphed some additional functionality to be coming in the next release around deduplication, you know, maybe possibly looking at erasure coding. And you know, those are through blog posts. So, but, you know, I look at it kind of as an incremental update, just kind of a little bit more scale, a little bit more, you know, not a whole lot in terms of functionality. You know, but they're going to continue to beat the drum on that whole vSAN as a platform to build upon. When it comes to vVols, you know, that was interesting because I saw the official HCL that was been updated. There's still only like 8 arrays on there, and none of them support the entire implementation of it. And then you looked at Chad's post about vVol implementation, and, you know, some of the EMC products aren't slated to support vVols until Q4 2016.
Yeah, so just for the listeners, real quick, I've got here that vMAX isn't due to support its general availability till Q1 2016, VNX Q2 2016, and then Extreme.io and vPlex second half of 2016. So my guess would be probably Q4. I mean, that is a long way out, especially, you know, considering the supposed close relationship between VMware and EMC. I'm quite staggered by that.
I think it has a lot more to do with the architecture of those systems and how they would be able to implement vVols than it does around EMC's ability to do it, right? I think there's some pretty heavy lifting that has to be done in regard to those products, and it's not simple. And then when you look at, you know, the players who do have a supported play in there, you know, they're definitely not household names. I mean, in terms of day-to-day storage.
It's funny, isn't it, that the industry produces a standard that is so difficult to implement, it's going to take years for the storage industry to catch up. Does that mean that the vVols technology is not very good, and that's why vendors can't implement it, or is it because vendors are not very good and they don't want to implement it?
It probably is a little bit of both, but I also kind of struggle with the whole concept around, I mean, think about this, that product's been in tech preview since 2011.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's
Which
not like people didn't know.
It's a failed technology. It must be so bad that nobody wants to touch it with a barge pole, or disruptive to their businesses that nobody wants to touch it with a barge pole.
I think it's the latter, the disruption to their business model. And if you think about it as a storage technology, you're not selling a whole lot of arrays if you're selling a bunch of flash and spinning disk inside the actual compute nodes themselves. So it runs counter to the prime EMC storage business to, you know, move that into the VMware side of things. And, you know, it just adds more complexity, more, you know, curiousness to how that whole platform is being implemented. And to be honest, I still struggle kind of with the whole use case around it. I understand why you'd want to do it, but I don't see a real compelling reason to switch to it.
That's it, right? Does anybody think it's actually going to be game-changing?
No. I it's all casual curiosity. Gabe used the word curious, right? It's casual. I spoke to a lot of people this week. You know, in my role, they're like, well, will it work with vVols? And I explain yes and why and how. But then I'm like, are you using it? No, not yet. You know?
Yeah. It's still fairly nascent. And, you know, I mean, given that Versto couldn't get it to work and that's where the technology originally pulled out of, you know, I just think it's a fairly heavy lift.
I see a lot of change in strategic nature. More people are beyond casual, serious with vSAN, you know?
Totally.
That's some more momentum to it for sure.
So can we pivot onto vSAN real quick then? So I totally get that it's like it's a point release, right? I did like the support for 2-node clusters now. I think that might potentially help a lot of small customers and customers that have small branch offices, you know, where you may want to just stick a couple of servers out there and not have the extra cost of sticking a third server. So I did think the 2-node clusters was probably a decent check in the box, right? But I'm really starting to think, you know, there's over 2,000 customers there now. It's VMware and all that. They've got all their fanboys and all of their loyal diehard customers. I don't knock them for that. As soon as, though, surely they release dedupe and compression, you know, is that not just going to kill every other storage array out there in the market?
No.
No?
Of course not.
No. I got to run, but I will say absolutely no.
Okay, so I'm curious why not then, because it really, to me, it feels like they'd then be unleashing vSAN. I mean, don't get me wrong, I know it's not going to take everything out, top, bottom, the lot, but I really think that would be taking the leash off vSAN, because it's, in my opinion, the way I look at it at least, is the big missing item, any kind of data efficiency technology. So, you know, inline dedupe and compression, that would really be a big old bonus for me if I was looking to deploy vSAN.
Well, the number one reason I am strongly no is because all consumers in the data center are not a VMware virtual machine currently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the number one reason I strongly say no. The second reason I strongly say no is that there are a huge expanse of innovation in storage that go about it differently, right? Dedupe and compression is one, or you know, quick cloning or whatever. There's so many other storage features, and the market is so advanced, right, and mature, that I think that there will always be opportunities to have something that's better. Right now, the fact that I don't actually know how much vSAN costs, but you know, that might be a factor. There is a certain amount of do-it-yourself versus have it built and supported by a proper storage company. Those are pretty significant business decisions that, you know, people might stop on.
But Rick, take cost out of the equation totally, right? And say, yeah, totally get right that you'd be able to get better. But when do you get to the point when good enough is good enough?
Oh,
right?
Quoting Hans, good enough is still good, right?
Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the thing. It comes down to a different number, the experience, you know, the speed. You know, you light it all up on vSAN if you have all this. And then, you know, I liked what I saw from Mark over at Tejile, right? Or I like what Tendry does, for example. I like what, you know, Gabe does at SolidFire. I like what Nimble does. You know, I like all these different things. But they all might have a different experience with the same kit and equipment, right? So I think that the experience and the supportability is a big deal. But that first rule of, you know, everything has to be VMware, that's kind of that's the first no table stake. And then secondly, the business decision about the experience and the supportability, that's the other one.
So Rick and Mark, you've both been at VMworld, right? How was the show for you? Is it, you know, does it still have that kind of dazzling appeal, and is it still a great show to go to? Was there anything announcements wise that you particularly thought was of interest?
Well, you know, among large industry events, for my professional role, this is one of the best still. Additionally, that's my job. I go to events and I do these things. I do this every week, right? So there's a certain novelty that is gone in the sense of, okay, it's another event. So with that being said, I still think it's very important. It's a very relevant event. I can get picky. I'm happy, by the way, it's going to be in Vegas next year. Just mix it up a little bit. I don't really like Vegas, but I don't really like this particular location of Moscone, right? I mean, just the surrounding city part, it could, you know, could be improved, that type of thing. But yes, still beneficial. What caught my eye is the new minimal Linux container host with Photon. That, I, you know what? What have I said the whole time along, guys, about containers? If it's an important workload, it's going to end up being managed, run, and protected like everything else that's important. And this, in my interest, this is great, because now you can run it on the rest of your infrastructure like everything else.
Cool. So before we go on to talking about Photon and containers and stuff like that, Mark, do you have anything from the show that you want to mention?
No, the Tejile and Simplivity and Rubrik all had big car displays. And there was other cars that are coming there. I also had one. So, I mean, some people said, when did this show become a car show? and of course, you know, the thing is, VMworld is such a huge storage show. It's, you know, there's a lot of storage there. I kind of think that it was not as, I might be wrong about this, but I suspect it was not as well attended as the previous couple of years. What do you think, Rick? I just didn't seem to have the same amount of folks at it. What's your opinion?
Yeah. They had a number of 23,000 badges printed, or however they qualify it. They said attendees, but I think they mean badges, because there's a lot that are like sponsors and stuff that aren't proper attendees. It wasn't as crowded, I'll give you that, but they also took over some new spaces as well. Like I think they're doing some sessions over at some of the hotels. So there's an intentional dilution of sorts, but I didn't go to any general sessions. I'm on lazy mode. I'm watching them, you know, on the streams. So I didn't see those crowd points. I'm leaving tonight, so I'm not going to the party. And then, you know, the Solutions Exchange, I did see. It felt crowded. Felt busy. Yeah. So I'd say the numbers are on par, but it is kind of spread out, you know. So I'd say it's, you know, it's still relevant to a lot of these people. And, you know, I'd say I'm making up a number here, but I'd say 10% of the people here are here for business development, right? They're, you know, a vendor or a vendor talking to a vendor. You know, everyone's, you know, vendor talking to end users and stuff like that. There's a lot of that biz dev stuff.
What, 90% are there to party?
Well, no, the base attendee, right? End users, customers of VMware, and to an extent, their partners, by the way, because VMware is consolidating that partner exchange event that they used to have with VMworld. And so that actually started this year. So that actually made it start on Saturday, believe it or not. So, you know, there's a lot of things they've tweaked with it, but it's top line, still very relevant to me, I think, to a lot of you know, end users, and of course to a lot of ecosystem players.
So the community really comes out for the show, you know, the V experts, the VMUG people. So, I mean, to me, I think the show is mostly about, you know, to a large degree about that community, and it's still a terrific show for them. It's great to see that people identify with that and being part of the community, and that there was no letdown there, I didn't think.
Cool. Mark, I think you made a really good point saying, you know, it's a really big storage show these days. I'd go as far as to say it's the premier storage event on the calendar each year now. To kind of bring you in a little bit, though, Greg, predominantly a network guy, but I know you probably dabble your hand in a ton of things. What does VMworld do for you?
I'm not a big fan of the big conferences anymore, so I'm not bothering to attend VMworld or Cisco Live or any of the Microsoft events. There's just too much going on. You can't actually get any signal between the noise. While it's great to go and meet people and have a party, I've got other things that I'm trying to achieve. So I'm less enamored of the big events than other people. In terms of networking news, VMware NSX did some really big announcements at VMworld. The big one, of course, is that NSX is now public cloud ready. So you can now connect your private cloud not only to the vRealize or the vCloud Air, whatever it's called this week. I can always get the names mixed up because VMware keeps renaming everything. But the vCloud Air and the hybrid cloud capability between the two, that got a boost this week with NSX. But then this morning in the keynote, they announced that VMware NSX is now able to run with the Amazon cloud, and they can integrate all of them together to bring a private network out of them. That is a really significant announcement, I think.
On the topic of NSX, though, is it anything ready at the moment? Like, is it production ready? Does it have real-world production customers out there? We talked about it, I think, I don't know, maybe like 5 or 6 episodes ago or something, and there were not very many customers out there, according to the press. In fact, I think it was a VMware statement. We were all quite shocked as to how few customers there were. So what's the state of play with NSX?
So NSX is the leading software-defined networking solution for the data center by a substantial number.
What's it up against, right? Cisco ACI, and that's
so Cisco. Well, Cisco's got several SDN strategies. It's got ACI is the main one today. It's got VTS and it's got XRC. There's a bit of confused messaging as the different BUs in Cisco compete to get customers' attention. But ACI is the prime one at the moment that Cisco wants to push forward to people. It has around about 900 paying customers today, whereas NSX has something up towards 1,800 to 2,000. So it's about twice as big as Cisco's ACI in the data center. And that's a significant number of customers considering that data centers – now, remember what you were just saying about storage, right? Nothing changes in an enterprise data center in less than a decade. So to pick up 2,000-odd customers inside of, say, 2 or 3 years is actually quite significant.
One question, though, on those numbers you had there, Greg, and it's outstanding that you had those numbers. Are the NSX customers – now, this is my suspicion. Are they service providers? Are they small businesses? Are they medium enterprises? And I would imagine the ACIs are larger. You know, is it an overlapping customer type or different industries?
My source of data is from the financial announcements that they publish, which is the public calls to the financial analysts, and you read the transcripts, and that's where it comes from. So you don't get the granularity of data out of that. The general concept would be, however, that you know, the VM, both ACI and NSX have a number of customers who've talked about their publicly about their experiences, you know, the reference customers and stuff like that. NSX has some major wins, certainly able to talk up some big ones, but then NSX has been around for a lot longer. It's a much more mature, and you'd sort of expect that. ACI has a lot of pilots, a lot of people who don't talk about it. You know, there's an entrenched part about what Cisco's doing. So you can't make a qualification about size, but I do know that the NSX business unit is seen as a growth unit from within VMware. There's no question that executives at VMware are very keen to see NSX get on the ground and running. The run rates that they're talking about for revenue for that BU, which is all scuttlebutt, I can't quote anything, is really substantial. So I guess if you want to boil it all down to something incredibly simple, 5 years ago, the only networking company on the planet in the data center was Cisco, and then maybe a few people using other people's stuff. And now it's Cisco and NSX. And we always put the two together. So if you're talking about SDN in the data center, it's always those two customers. Right there, VMware's made a major change in the industry just by being mentioned in the same breath there.
You know what? The number 2,000 as well, that's probably roughly about the number of vSAN customers as well. So, And I've always thought the uptake of vSAN was pretty decent. So if those numbers, you know, I don't suppose we even know if those 2,000 numbers are those just how many licenses are out there, you know.
It's customers, who've paid for the product. So the financial statement said people who've paid for the product.
Right, but not necessarily implementing the product, because a lot of people have
not
stuff.
Not necessarily in production, necessarily. Yeah. But remember, this is still the enterprise you're talking about. You're talking decade-long transition cycles for anything to go. Like, it took VMware from, 1996 until 2015 to get where it is today.
Agreed. So let's talk about something else then, which Rick brought up earlier, which also won't be changing the world overnight, but containers there. So talking about Photon and things like that at VMworld, what I wanted to ask you, Rick, was not necessarily the technical detail of anything that was announced. I've probably read a little bit around that. But was there just what was the feel around Photon and the impact of containers on VMware? Was it big on the agenda there? Were people talking about it? Or was it just like in the and other stuff towards the bottom of the?
Oh, no. I think it was my personal opinion is it was the kind of the anchoring announcement. For one, they had the livery, the visual element of the web page before the event even showed a ship with containers on it.
Okay.
So I think they changed that. But at the time, a week or two ago, that's what the visual was. And secondly, you know, we talk about casual curiosity, right? At least in my role, I'm sure Mark and Gabe get it too, where, you know, if you work for a vendor that touches some of these different things, you get like, well, how does this work? How does that work with you or whatever? I get a lot of probably more than casual curiosity about the container strategy, but having it in a platform like the JEVM, the Just Enough Virtualization, that very lightweight engine to run these containerized apps, that is very attractive to El Ricotron. And just really, again, my rule from the start, if it's important, it's going to need to be managed in the data center and protected, and some visibility to it, right? You can't. I was shaking my head for, you know, months about this whole containerization where, you know, you just throw it in and do whatever you want. Well, no, there's still controls. The business rules don't change. They just are amplified. And sure, they're delivered well and quicker with these new technologies, but, you know, what if things go wrong and what's going on? Those types of questions will still need to be answered. So I was very happy for Photon.
So the interesting thing about containers isn't that you'll ever provision them the way you do today. They'll always be part of a PaaS platform or an orchestration platform like vRealize. So if you look at Mesos or Kubernetes or one of the other Docker orchestration systems or container orchestration systems, that's really where it is. And that's going to take years to play out. So you saw Pivotal recently lose its CEO. He stood down to go back to South Africa to get away from operational day-to-day management. I'm trying to think of his name. You were talking about it last week.
Paul Moritz.
Yeah. So the scuttlebutt is that he's gone home to go to manage the farm because he's had enough of working at a high level. But, you know, Pivotal and Cloud Foundry was going to change the whole PaaS platform. Pivotal is that whole Cloud Foundry relies on containers. So having Photon means that you can now have a PaaS platform, have your developers writing code, clicking a button and deploying directly into Photon containers on top of the VMware infrastructure, on top of your SDDC/Evo Rack platform, and you'll have an end-to-end capability. So Photon, for me, is about you have a container technology that's going to run on VMware. It integrates with Cloud Foundry. So if you're a believer in the federation, if you think it'll survive, there's your end-to-end. And once you've got your containers running in VMware, you have your storage is all set up, your networking is all there, your compute structure is all there. You just run it inside of a VM and boom, away you go. All your management tools are in place. So not very efficient. It's not very practical. It's going to be very expensive, but that's the enterprise way. We love that.
Yeah, and you know, all those kind of things that you're talking about there are music to the ears of enterprises that are being forced down the Dockerize or containerize your apps type route. You know, they want to have an established, trusted partner like VMware with all of their existing tools and infrastructure and support and all that kind of stuff are out there to hold their hand and support them with it. So, yeah, hey, maybe this is going to end up being the annual industry's premier container event as well in the future.
Hey, wouldn't doubt it. I mean, it might. But you're right about it being the storage. It's really the best ecosystem for storage. Mm. I mean, it's not SNW and everything else from event standpoint. And I'm kind of with Greg on the events. The research that, you know, you can do on your own. The events are great for networking and stuff. But, you know, in my role, I have to go there. But in regards to storage, there is no, you know, broad ecosystem attempt because the biggest players have their own events, right? So, of course, they're not going to have the whole market there. So, yeah, maybe, you know, they've built this community. The only thing that's missing, right, is every other core virtualization, right? Like there's no, you know, Hyper-V,
sure,
you know, on demo. There's no, you know, Zen server.
I'm a big fan of the independent events. So I like interop and I like going to in events where it's much more generic or, you know, niche, incredibly niche.
Yeah, I call it unaligned. They're unaligned to a particular vendor ecosystem. And yeah, I like those too, Greg. They're hard to find though.
I like the Tech Field Day events as well, personally, because I think you get an opportunity to really dive into a technology there and find out about, you know, sometimes the niche vendors out there as well that don't have a big platform quite often. I'm a big fan. Okay, so away from VMworld, but also I guess it was kind of announced there as well. Mark, I did see that Tejal had been in the news, at least on the register, talking about new ultra-dense products and also some talk about NVMe-based fabrics as well. I definitely want to pick Greg's brain around NVMe-based fabrics. But Mark, can you give us just a quick rundown on what you're doing with SanDisk and people like that?
Well, you know, I think this is the direction that the whole flash industry is going to go. And I think really it's the whole SAN industry is going to go this way, which is to incorporate high-density flash, right? You know, the whole idea of hybrid storage started with, you know, flash and disk, and then there were all flash arrays. And I think the way hybrid is going to go to fast flash and slower flash. And so what we were demonstrating this week was, you know, SanDisk is a strategic investor in Tejal. And so we're demonstrating their IntelliFlash half a petabyte in 3U flash units, right? And so the idea is that, you know, given a 3-to-1 dedupe ratio, you can have 10 petabytes of flash in a single rack unit. And that's a lot. I believe that's the future of what this business is going to be is, you know, big flash, some flash faster than others.
You know, it's interesting, actually. You're spouting out some numbers there, half a terabyte in 3U and what have you. I know I'm totally dragging it off the...
No, petabyte.
Did I say half a terabyte?
Yeah.
So I was reading something earlier today about Seagate have released, they haven't released, but they've announced they're going to release an 8 terabyte shingle disk drive and also incorporate it into, I think they were talking, was it a 5U system that would have over 600 terabytes and then in a rack you'd have like 5 petabytes in a rack. So it seems like, you know, there's this crazy push towards big...
extreme capacity.
Extreme capacity.
High density.
High density.
Is the way to think about it. Yeah.
So I have a customer that I work with. They have a 20 petabyte array system, and they're very keen to see these disks come out. But the problem that we've got is with the 8 terabyte is that the rebuild time, you're getting out towards 2 days to get a rebuild out from an 8 terabyte drive. And that's real problems with then creating error correcting algorithms so that you can recover the data in the event of a failure, right? So they are serious problems there.
So the rebuild times, of course, with Flash and the whole thing with Flash, it's much, much faster.
Yes, that's right. I think what you're seeing here is that the fact is that Seagate can make an 8-terabyte drive is because the cost of actually manufacturing, the cost of metalwork and design and getting these things is so cheap. I come up with a regular storyline around commoditization. So 20 years ago, building a drive was a multi-year effort. It required tens of millions of dollars. For Seagate to now just extend the existing drive format, you know, all they've already got the engines being made, the framework's already in place, the production lines are in place. The incremental cost to build an 8-terabyte drive is not a great deal, and it's worth producing a run and seeing who uses it. You don't need to make an entire market to buy them. You just have to produce them and put them out there. So they can suck it and see, in the same way that Intel can continue to produce more CPUs every year. And, you know, the cost of manufacturing hardware is much less or, you know, effectively trivial compared to where we were just 5 years ago.
But Greg, they can't, do like a, build on demand kind of thing. That's a business where they have to have massive manufacturing to get the cost down.
Sure. So they've evaluated the market and there'll be enough people to make the run. But it's not like, you used to have, they would only make one hard drive and they'd have to sell 10 million of them. They can now make a return at 1 million units. For example, I'm just making numbers up, but you get the point.
Hey, 95% of all statistics are made up on the fly.
We'll go with that. The thing is, though, with the disk drive, right, rebuild times aside, right, but the bigger they get, and especially when you start implementing funky technologies like shingled recording techniques and things like that, write performance, at least after you've written to a track at least once, just nosedives. It becomes an absolute pig. But is this something, Mark, that in the flash space, as we get further down the road of being ultra dense and higher storage capacities per flash drive and stuff in the future, is write performance going to nosedive just the same as it does with the disk drive, or are we going to see it cope a little bit better at least?
No, I think it'll cope a lot better. Depends on, it's all system architecture stuff, right? So you can have memory and fast flash, and slower flash. So if if it's new stuff coming in, it's going to be going into memory and faster flash. So I think your write speeds are going to be a lot faster. A disk drive system can be built with a lot of memory front-ended too, yeah. Right? So it's just it needs to be non-volatile memory so you don't lose it, and then you get into all this stuff. Is it battery backup, DRAM? Is it high-speed NVRAM? What is it? All that stuff. And there's a lot of architectural things that you can do. But what I think is exciting, actually, is that you can if you talk about a lot of memory, and because you've got memory speeds and you can read really fast, that it allows you to do dedupe against a pretty massive size of pool. And so you get much better dedupe ratios, data reduction ratios, all those kinds of things. I think the storage systems of the future are going to not be written to necessarily nearly as much as what the data is that it stores because of dedupe.
I also wonder, companies like Amazon and Facebook who want to do cold storage, an 8-terabyte drive can be very effective as a cold storage unit, and there might be just a new market there for, open compute type platforms that do very, very large storing that actually doesn't get read and write all that much at all.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, those drives really aren't built to be overwritten very much, right? They are. Those are drives that are, you wouldn't call them, write once, read many, but it's kind of close to that. They are really for cold storage.
And if you think about it, if Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft Azure were the only customers for that drive, that's enough
yes,
to make
it
a
is,
market.
Yeah. And you know what? It is almost perfect for, you put up a family video or whatever, you write it once, you read it 3 or 4 times in the first week, and then maybe once again in the rest of its lifetime. A disk drive like that, almost perfect for that kind of a workload, right? Brilliant.
Yep.
Slightly different, though. Tejal were also in the news talking about the potential need and development in the future of NVMe-based fabrics. So saying that, we're going to have all of this super fast storage in the future. I mean, we've got it now, right? But it's going to get faster and faster with all the memory-based architectures and things like that. But if we're housing all of that in an array that's kind of away from our servers, then things like 10 gig and 40 gig Ethernet, fiber channel, and potentially even InfiniBand are not going to provide the kind of throughput and the low latencies that we could potentially get, okay, if we went with an NVMe-based fabric. Great and all. I kind of totally get that from a technical perspective, but I do wonder, I mean, if I was a potential customer here, and I'm really looking at you, I think, Greg, from a networking perspective, right? But I'm thinking as a customer, right? So I now need to plumb an NVMe-based fabric between my storage and my servers. So I think it's like probably those big old thick PCIe cables to a PCIe switch. Even if it's not that, right, it's different to what I do now, right? So my guys in the data center are all cool with patching, fiber, and all that kind of stuff between cabs, things like that. We've got standard tools to manage Ethernet networks and fiber channel networks and what have you, and it's all broken down into different teams and what have you. I just don't know how I would bite off, despite all the great low latencies.
It seems silly to develop a storage-specific bus to transfer data. It's like, you know, back in the days of SCSI, we developed a bus so that hard drives could talk to the CPU and we could do direct memory transfers from the drives to the memory of the motherboard. And here we are 25 years later still doing the same old thing, which is kind of dumb. That NVMe Express is basically a interface for SSDs to transfer data to from. And you can build a fabric out them all you like. I mean, we could do the same thing with PCI. There was a PCI fabric for a while. You can do it with InfiniBand. But they're all doomed to failure against some of the more universal buses that are coming out. So if you've been tracking the Intel Omnipath initiative, and they're talking about fabric, like signaling fabrics to go between CPUs and memory, and these will actually support multiple external interfaces. So not just storage and SSDs, but also network cards and video cards in a unified fabric. Instead of building a unique storage fabric that's like a snowflake and it's only, you know, blah, 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 it really is time for the storage industry and networking to come together and say, we need a universal bus between the CPU and the external I/O and have the same thing all the way around. And that's, I think, I'm looking more towards things like Omnipath to signal that for that future.
So could NVMe not be that? I mean, does it necessarily have to be henpecked into being just storage? You know, could it not be like a memory bus as well?
No, it's custom designed for SSDs on the PCI bus.
So I need to do some research around NVMe then. So, okay, why would they not go with something like InfiniBand? And when I say they, I'm talking about the industry in general, right? Because there have been one or two companies talking about it. And I kind of get it in theory, right? That, you know, we're getting all these super fast storage arrays and then we're sticking a fairly high latency network in between them. Well, what's with that? Get that totally, yeah? Is InfiniBand not good enough? Because that seems to have had like a bit of a new lease of life over the last couple of years.
So InfiniBand's like Fibre Channel. As a networking technology, it was designed back in the time when money wasn't a consideration in the design. It had to be fast. So whatever money you could waste to make it faster, or in the case of Fibre Channel, whatever money you could waste to make it more reliable, waste away. And that was what was done. But we now live in an era where Ethernet says that near enough is good enough, or good enough is just good, and we can make do with much more practical universal type things. What you've got to remember again is it comes back to hardware being commoditized. So if there are Ethernet chipsets out there that have lossless crossbar fabrics inside them, it is much cheaper to go and buy the existing fabric chipsets and use those than it is to go and start building custom silicon and going through years and years of development for things like NVMe. And why don't you just go and use something that everybody else is using and make it cost efficient, make it universal. Everybody's got the same software drivers. We can reuse the same code between networking and storage and memory and videos instead of reinventing the wheel over and over and over.
The reason, Greg, is that when you get into the high transaction workloads, people are crazy about low latency and performance there, right? And if there is a small difference, it's worth it. A lot of customers will pay it.
Yes, and then the technology will catch up and make it obsolete.
Yeah, but if it takes a decade to do it, then the customers think it's worth it.
So Intel's Omnipath looks set to, in my view at the moment, it looks set to eclipse NVMe within years. I don't think NVMe is probably still born in the face of other fabrics that are evolving around it.
It's a proper rat race, though, isn't it? Because then surely something will come on and just eclipse Omnipath as well, you know, before it's even in full-scale production.
Yeah, what about fiber channel 16 gig or 32 gig? Why aren't we putting out 32 gig fiber channel drives? Right? The same argument applies to NVMe, in my view. It's the universality, the commoditization. There's no space in the market anymore to have unique snowflake solutions for a niche market like storage or for networking. We need universal solutions to all of the problems, and having a standard fabric is where we need, and that's where Omnipath is headed. There are others. Intel's leading Omnipath, which probably means it'll get up and run because Intel's the leading contender.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit then. So I did see a storage startup called, I don't even know how to pronounce this right, Reduxio or Reduxio. Don't know if anybody's ever heard of them, right? They were founded in 2012. They've had three rounds of funding, raised $27 million. And so they're in the news this week for talking about snapshots being like so yesterday. Why would you bother doing snapshots, right? They've got this new technology, I can't even remember what it's called. I did scribble it down somewhere, where they're talking about doing some kind of like almost proper continuous data protection, right? So saying, you know, you put one of their systems in and there's no management around scheduling snapshots and things like that. You can literally just recover any data from any time down to like the second level. So, you know, from not just from midnight yesterday, but from 11:27:54 if that was when the file was last around. And I found myself reading about them thinking, okay, yeah, fair enough. They do all of this inline, in-memory, dedupe and compression and all of that kind of stuff. But like, when do we get to the point where it's just not worth starting another storage startup? When does the market become so saturated with startups that all do supposedly the best dedupe and the best compression and the best data recovery? And they've raised 27 million quid. And like, I don't know. I mean, they've got some decent investors, right? They've got, I mean, Carmel have been in for two rounds, Intel Capital for two rounds, Jerusalem Venture Partners for two rounds, Seagate are in leading the most recent round. You know, those are pretty big names. But are they, like, just giving money away to anybody at the moment? Because to make it now in the storage space, surely you've got to have something that's just insanely game-changing. I mean, the Pures and the Tejiles and all of those companies that are already out there and fairly well established now, they all do pretty much all of those things, right? I mean, when are we going to stop seeing new storage startups come?
Well, we're not.
Are we not? Surely we've got to at some point, right? The money's got to run out. You can't just keep seeding money into every person that comes along and says, we're going to do dedupe or compression or whatever. It feels to me like we need something new.
Well, there's plenty of money. Money's not a problem in the world. So that I'm not worried about that problem. And there's a need. So my short answer is no, but I'm real curious what Mark thinks.
Yeah, so I don't know that we need CDP again. I think CDP has proven to not be that attractive, that not that many people need that kind of granularity of data that was written.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can get close to that using, you know, Veeam's product, using Rubrik's product, using other products. I think those things are really good enough. I think the success that Veeam has had over the last 5 years has been astounding. You know, and that's what people want, and they voted with their billfolds, and CDP has never taken off. And, you know, Microsoft tried to do it, you know, and, you know, with add-ons to, or not add-ons, but just things included in Windows Server. That never worked. I don't see it. I don't see CDP happening. I don't see people clamoring for it. I never, ever talk to customers that say, this is what I really want.
And just to add to that, I think the second part, I think Mark's nailed the market mechanics there quite correctly. But also remember that it's never been cheaper for a startup to start business. So there's readily available amounts of capital, as Rick alluded to. But the second part is that it costs almost nothing to hire an office and some MacBooks and get some people in to write some code, and the cost of hardware that you need to build a storage array is far cheaper than it was a decade ago. So, you know, getting an OEM like from a company like Dot Hill, you know, the years gone by where manufacturing a framework and mounting drives and the airflows, that can all just be OEM'd out. You're talking that startups can come to market very quickly at very low cost, and I'm talking, you know, a few millions, whereas 5 years ago, it would have been tens of millions. And so there's several dynamics in the change here. So companies can start up and fail fast, but only waste a few million in the process.
So let me tell you a little bit about the the money part, right? And one of the things I do is I just intercept, you know, like when I'm at my booth for work, I'll intercept people that are just not a normal conversation. And this event brings the basically analysts from venture capitalist firms, basically private analysts, where they're doing market data and they're asking, you know, business questions and stuff like that. You would be shocked, guys, how many of those people are at these events and, you know, scouting the market and the industry, looking at the, you know, like Reduxio, this new one here. By the way, they won Best of Show from the Tech Target Awards. That's something. So they must be doing something right. But, you know, there's a lot of that, and you know, market analyst type stuff that goes on to venture capital. I can see these guys a mile away. They're always really, really well dressed too. And they'll come up and start asking me questions like that. And
what, a really well dressed guy will come and talk to you? Yeah, with you, because you're always wearing green at these events, right?
No, I only wore green once.
Is that right?
Broke the rules.
Rick looks pretty badass in black.
Yeah, I do the black thing. But.
Okay, so one thing that we didn't pick up on that was kind of big news from VMworld this week was around Evo Rack, or Evo SDDC as they're now calling it. Greg, I know you want to say one or two things on that as we wrap the show up, yeah?
Yeah, sure. So the thing to note here is that the – I don't know if you've been tracking Evo Rack. Have you talked about it in the shows previously?
Yeah.
And VMware was trying to sort of get a turnkey solution where the hardware is blessed by the special priests and priestesses over at VMware so that you can only buy certain types of hardware. That theoretically should make it work, because apparently using standard hardware doesn't work unless you get it blessed by special priests and priestesses. Do you ever find that weird, or is that just me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the Evo Rack has not been a huge success, is according to the scuttlebutt I hear. So they're rebadging it again, renaming it, calling it Evo, just SDDC or VMware SDDC. And it's a fully prescriptive framework, was the byline that they gave us. So you have to go and buy nominated hardware from nominated vendors in nominated architectures. And they are HP, Dell, and Quanta.
But there's nothing available until 2016. Along those lines, I don't think.
Oh, and a V-block. V-block is the other
one. Of course, yeah.
Yep. So from my point of view, it's very interesting, because in the networking space, what they're actually using is white box switches and Cumulus Linux on the switching infrastructure as the blessed platform at this point in time, which is really, really interesting, because it's not Cisco, it's not HP, it's a, you know, effectively a white box, which is really unique in my business. So I think it's interesting to see what VMware is doing here. They're rebadging it. They're giving it prescriptive. What they're also doing at the same time is having a bet the other way, and they're producing validated designs. They've relaunched their validated design thing, so that if you were going to go out and buy Cisco UCS, or if you've got HP servers on EMC storage or your current strategy and you want to stick with that, then these validated designs are going to fill in the gap. So you've got the choice to go out and buy an SDDC, which is a validated rack in the blessed format. And the priests and priestesses have blessed it, and you can go and buy your VMware, and it'll all work, guaranteed. Everybody's going to guarantee it that it works. Or you can go and get a validated design, and it's best effort there, but you've got some guidelines on how to deploy.
It's interesting, because I know that in previous shows, Gabriel has voiced his opinion that Evo Rail, he thinks, will be a failed effort, and that it'll go nowhere and it'll eventually be closed down. I know that with regards to SDDC here, they've got a component of it. Well, I say they will have, is my understanding, a component called SDDC Manager, which, for all I know about it, is trying to be this like Uber management product to manage everything in your data center, which to me, from my experience with any product that's even attempted to come close to anything like that, sounds horrific. I mean, even just in the storage world, and I know the world's a bit of a different place these days because there are a lot more APIs, open APIs and things like that. But back in the day, any heterogeneous storage management product was horrific. It didn't work. It was at least 12 months behind what the Array's native tools could do, and nobody would trust using it to provision storage in case it bust things up. And here they are coming along with SDDC Manager, this, like, I don't know, I think I called it Uber management product, right, that's going to try and manage your entire data center, bring everything under its
So what they've done with the Evo SDDC is they've deployed a thing called the Hardware Management Services, which is a platform. It's just like a vBlock. You get the special hardware management thing that the vBlock gets. And so VMware is producing one, and then the vendors can snap into that existing one. So theoretically, you know, people like us can become skilled at VMware's Evo SDDC hardware management services, and no matter what platform's underneath, so Dell or Quanta or VCE, it all looks like the same management platform. The interesting thing about this is that, you know how they've been talking about the scuttlebutt of EMC backing itself into VMware?
Yeah.
That starts to look far more credible, because this is all looks like a lot of what VCE has been doing is being backed into this product.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why are they duplicating all of these things over and over?
Stew on that until next week then. Well, thanks for being on the show, guys. Really appreciate it. Safe journeys back from VMworld, those of you who are there. Greg, thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure. Yeah. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Remind us who you are and where we can find you.
So my name is Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters as at etherealmind.
Marvelous. You even got a round of applause from Mark.
The analog clap. Thank you for that, Mark.